Hello, it's Thursday 10th of June. I'm Hannah Pearson from Per Anderson. On today's show, Gary Bauman of Check-In Asia and I are delighted to welcome Bill Healy, a vastly experienced specialist in hospitality, golf, casino and spa tourism across Southeast Asia. So, let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. So today we're excited to be chatting with Bill Healy, a hospitality, golf, casino and spa tourism expert, travel editor, journalist and fellow podcaster. Bill has extensive experience across Southeast Asia. There's so much to talk about. And he joins us today from Las Vegas in the US. So, Bill, thanks very much for coming on the show. How are you today and how's Vegas doing right now?
Well, thank you very much. First, I'd like to say thank you to both of you. I follow both of you on LinkedIn and Twitter. The information you provide is wonderful. It's fabulous. I use the information quite a bit on our decisions within our company on our next travel and where we're focused. So thank you very much for that. Las Vegas is recently opening up. The weekend was busy, a bit too busy for my taste. So I think we might be going a bit too quick, but yeah, Vegas is back to what it was, or getting back to what it was pre-pandemic.
Well, that's great news, given there's so much stasis here in Southeast Asia. So, Bill, we've got plenty to pack in over the next 30 minutes. Let's start by going back to the beginning. Your career spans over 30 years in hospitality, casino, gaming, golf, spa, and leisure industries. And you've traveled and worked around the world, including many countries here in Southeast Asia. What got you hooked on travel and tourism in the very first place?
I think I've always loved travel. I've been hooked on it from as far back as I remember. Just growing up, my home state is Michigan, and growing up, we'd generally take a 12-hour driving trip to Pennsylvania to visit my grandmother, or we'd go 20 hours down to Florida to visit my cousins, or we'd 2 or 3 day trip to California just to visit California for trade shows. So travel has always been a part of my life. In, say, 1968, my father started a golf handicapping service firm, which became one of the world's biggest golf handicapping systems. And I joined the firm after college, and I took up the sales and implementation. So I was often on a plane or in a car going around the U.S. to sell and implement systems. And a step further with that, by the late 80s, early 90s, we were implemented in Mexico, Canada, Bermuda, Kenya, Guam, Korea, Japan, Australia, just all over the place. So I was always the one I chose to take those trips. I'd be on a plane and I'd spend 3 weeks in Korea, 3 weeks in Japan. I just loved it.
It sounds amazing. And those are some super long car journeys compared to where Gary and I are from in the UK. you drive that fast, you'll be in the sea. When did you first visit Southeast Asia and what was the attraction? What kept drawing you back?
Well, in 1997, I was invited by an IT firm to come down to KL and meet with some golf courses, meet with the Malaysia Golf Association, meet with the IT people to see about marketing and supporting the system in Malaysia. So that was my first trip. And I remember very well, Subang Airport was the international airport in KL at the time. And I remember walking out of the airport and this pungent smell just hit me, the sweet smell of the cigarettes in Malaysia, the local cigarettes. It was a smell that I never experienced in the U.S. And then getting into our hotel, I remember the sign said, no durians allowed. And I'm thinking, why don't they allow durians? What's a durian? And I soon experienced that and loved it. And to this day, I love durian and try to get it whenever I can. In the U.S., I really can't. Nobody will share that with me. So that was my first experience in KL. And I decided the growth of the market in Malaysia was the best golf growth market in Southeast Asia at that time. So I decided to come back in 98 or so and live in KL for a full year. And I chose Brookfields. I know you know Brookfields quite well. Which is a great mix. You had the local Malay, the Bumiputra, you had the Indian Malay, you had the Chinese Malay, and I just loved the mixture of people and the mixture of foods. It was just a draw that kept me in KL for a while. Then I branched out into Thailand. I branched out into Indonesia, Cambodia, Laos. I just loved the whole region, just the variations.
So before we talk about the rest of your experiences in Southeast Asia, let's just focus a little bit on Malaysia then, your time there. You'd be interested to know that they still have do not bring durian notices in many hotels here. But when you were working in Malaysia and looking at golf tourism and trying to develop, which were the particular parts of the country that were, you know, you were working in?
Mostly around KL and Padang Jai and all the whole center of Malaysia. And I'd go down to Singapore. In Brickfields, I could easily hop on a bus and get down to Singapore in 4 to 5 hours, sleep on a bus, work on the bus, and I'd be in Singapore soon. So I really focused on KL and surrounding parts of KL, and then also in Johor. I appreciate Johor as well, just the growth of golf in Johor, which attracts a lot of these Singaporean golfers on the weekends. Occasionally I'd get over to Sabah and Sarawak, but most of the time it was in KL and Johor.
So over the past 24 years, Bill, since you first arrived in KL, you've lived and worked in KL, Bangkok, Phnom Penh, and you spent 14 years in Bali as well. You must have seen so many changes across the region during that time. You know, what memories stick in your mind? What are the most inspiring? And you know, what kind of changes have been the most important?
Well, for instance, when I moved into Bali in, I think, about 2004, whenever I needed to connect to the internet, I couldn't find a hotel. I couldn't find a business or restaurant with internet. So I'd have to go to an internet cafe and log onto their computers and do all of my work from an internet cafe. And that's changed considerably now. Everybody's got their mobile phones. You can get internet connection either through your SIM card or at basically any hotel, any restaurant in Bali and throughout Indonesia. So that was one huge change. Also, the international calls, if I had to call another country or if I had to call Java from Bali, it was an expensive call. But now with the smartphones, we can use apps and use WhatsApp, WeChat, Skype or whatever, and we can communicate with people back home or anywhere in Indonesia or anywhere worldwide, and it was a free call. So technology is quite advanced in those years. And also just the number of five-star and upscale hotels in Bali, in Jakarta, in Bangkok, all over. It's really exploded from my early days there.
Absolutely. So you were actually due to be in Cambodia and Vietnam last year when the international borders shut due to COVID. What projects should you have been working on last year and this year?
Well, the last country I was in before I came back to the States was in Cambodia. And I came back to the States to visit family and to attend a conference in Las Vegas. And so I thought, oh, I'll just go back to the States for a couple of months and I'll be back in Vietnam and Cambodia. And we're in the process of developing regional golf booking systems that can take advantage of applications like WeChat and Line and so on. So we're working with both golf club management systems, but also regional booking systems that I was hoping to be on the ground working with the local people there. So I've resorted to working with them through Zoom or Microsoft Teams, but nothing quite as good as actually being on the ground working with the local people.
So let's talk a little bit about golf tourism. That's an interesting project that you're developing there. I mean, golf tourism really has developed significantly across Southeast Asia over the past couple of decades, and you've been involved in that. You've worked as a golf journalist. You've also worked with golf clubs. You also worked in golf technology. Tell us a little bit more about how you've seen that golf tourism sort of boom over the past couple of decades and where it could have gone sort of up to the pandemic.
Well, initially my focus was the golf club management systems at just a single club or multiple clubs. And their advances were to get into revenue management where they could charge a different rate for different golfers based on the day of the week or the time of day. And revenue management is a complex concept for some of these golf clubs to get into because they just don't have the education level or the experience with revenue management. Sure, airlines have been doing it since the early 80s. Hotels have been doing it from the early 80s. But the golf technology has been lagging behind by 15 or 20 years. So our first focus was just to get the intelligence implemented at the golf clubs. More recently, we've been integrating them into large websites where you can say, I'm going to travel to Kuala Lumpur, I want to play golf, what's available on this certain day or that certain weekend. And now we're also focused on integrating the apps like WeChat and Line and so on into the mix. So you can just be on your smartphone and book a hotel, book an airline, book a car, and also book your golf. And if you get into most of the large travel apps like Expedia, Kayak, or whatever, you can still do your airline, your car, your hotel, but golf is not part of that mix yet. So we're working on that.
Yeah, I can imagine that would be a significant revenue generator, especially for tourism, and that OTAs must be desperate for any other kind of ancillary revenue rather than just flights and hotels right now.
Exactly. And it's been a journey we've been pushing for a few years, and I think we're almost there. I think the industry is almost there. The OTAs, I think, want it, but they're still looking for a way to do it. Because then we have to take that technology and integrate it back to the club system. And there's still dozens of club systems that we would have to integrate with. So it's a bit more work.
You mentioned there that you're using, you know, you can integrate apps like WeChat and WhatsApp. Was the primary market for this mechanism Asian tourists, or is it an international project?
Mostly Asian, because there's still a mix. I mean, if you go to Thailand, you're using Line. You go to China, of course, you're using WeChat. Indonesia's using a lot of the WhatsApp, but I don't think a lot of the overseas, a lot of people in Europe or America, I don't think are looking to use those apps to integrate into golf bookings in Asia. Rather, they'll use an OTA, or they'll use travel group on the ground who will just do all the booking for them. So it's the apps are more for the people who want to book something nearby, just a few days or a week or two out.
So golf tourism has obviously taken a big hit, like all kinds of tourism over the last 15 months in Southeast Asia. What do you see its prospects being? You know, can it expand beyond what is a fairly niche market, or is the fact that it is such a defined niche segment its strongest factor?
I think being a niche market is its strong factor. I don't expect it's going to grow very much in the coming years. I remember back to Malaysia in the late 90s when I was there. They did grow quick, but they also grew too quick, that at times a course would have no golfers on for the full day, or they just have a foursome on for the full day. They couldn't even give golf away. A few of the courses I remember were saying, come play golf, we'll give you cart free, just pay for your meals when you're done playing golf. And so they had to shutter a few of the courses. And I think with this pandemic as well, the courses are realizing that we're struggling to get golfers on the course now, and we probably will for the foreseeable future. So the courses I know under development now are delaying the completion of the project. And yeah, I think that over the coming years, we're going to see current courses under construction will be completed, but not a lot will be newly developed in the next few years.
It's an interesting point about where it goes next. We, both Hannah and I, were on a webinar on the other night with the Tourism Authority of Thailand, talking about Phuket and the reopening. They're obviously opening to open from July the 1st. And two of the areas they said that they are starting to get inquiries for when Phuket does open were from weddings from India and golfers from Singapore. So there is a bright spot, hopefully.
Well, interesting about the Indian weddings. When I was in Bali, I remember some of the hotels that I worked with the spa systems, they'd actually close the whole hotel, like the W Hotel in I think Seminyak. They closed the whole hotel just for an Indian wedding for a full weekend. So outside guests were not allowed. So I know some of those Indian weddings can be huge. But yeah, Singaporean golfers, right now Singapore is in a good position because they just have a handful of courses now, and they've got a huge golfing population. So they all stay in Singapore and play golf, but they're used to going to Johor to play golf on the weekends. But if Phuket's going to open up before Johor, then they're going to hop on a plane and go to Phuket and play golf. So I can see that.
So in China, for example, the government has long sought to crack down on golf club development in favor of other types of land utilization. Do you think that we're going to see more golf development across Southeast Asia after the pandemic?
Yeah, I remember it implemented systems in China, and they were crazy for golf. And they built a lot of courses that the government would then later shut down because the government doesn't support that type of thing. So they'd have to repurpose the land into agriculture or industry or residential properties. After the pandemic, I don't really see any courses closing. I think they're going to struggle through and all try to make it. But I don't see a huge growth in golf, at least for 3 to 5 years past the pandemic. it's going to take that long just to build golf participation again in the courses they have.
So let's move on to another area of specialty of yours, Bill, which is, again, is a really, really important, or was pre-pandemic, a really important niche sector here in Southeast Asia, and that's casino tourism. It's boomed across Asia over the last decade. If you look at Singapore, Macau, Malaysia, Cambodia, Philippines, Japan's been looking to develop this sector. Obviously, as we talked about with golf tourism, COVID-19 has dealt a huge blow to casino tourism, and opinions do tend to differ at the moment about its potential recovery. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I read just a few days ago that Resort World Genting had to close down again for the third time in the last 15 months. And I think in a month or two, they're going to reopen the casino portion of it. The theme park at Resort World Genting, I think, is going to stay closed until December when the schools are on holiday again and they can open up and have all the students and families holiday there. Naga World has, I think, last week reported that they're laying off or have laid off more than 600 employees because of the pandemic. Hoiana Resort in Vietnam was supposed to have their grand opening in the last 6 to 12 months, but again, that's been delayed because of the pandemic. So I think the large casinos are going to be struggling a bit longer, but I think there's a segment of the market that's actually going to do fairly well, and that's the border casinos. If you go to Cambodia or Laos, they've got quite a few casinos on the border with Vietnam or on the border with Thailand or with the border between Myanmar and China. There's a lot of casinos there. I think they're going to do quite well because the locals there treat those as like community centers. They go there, they have fun, they gamble with their friends. And I think the population, the participation in gambling in those border casinos is going to pick up a bit quicker than they will in the big five-star integrated resorts.
What about the two big mega centers, Macau and Singapore? Macau has had a relatively progressive recovery. Obviously, it relies exclusively at the moment on Chinese tourists, but Singapore is going to struggle. It has these two mega resorts. And like you mentioned with Naga World, you know, they have been laying off staff. They've been reporting big losses. It's going to be a long road back for those, isn't it?
I think so. Even in Singapore, I think it'll be a bit difficult. The attraction with Singapore is that it is a island state, a very big business destination, and they have a lot of conferences. So I think the conferences will pick up again and help Marina Bay Sands and Resort World as well. I've got friends from Michigan, friends from the States that have made business trips to conferences in Marina Bay Sands, and I think that'll pull people back.
Do you think that we'll start to see more local tourists in Southeast Asia being permitted to visit casinos as another way to generate some domestic tourism revenue after the pandemic? Because in many countries in the region, local tourists are still not really permitted to go inside these casinos, right? They've been mainly aimed at international tourists.
Yes and no. It's a bit mixed. It's I think Resort World Genting likely won't. I think that religion in Malaysia is going to be restrictive. I don't think the Malay government's going to let the locals in Malaysia go to Resort World there. In Vietnam, they had a three-year trial where certain casinos could have locals go there to gamble because I think a 2017 study said that Vietnam was losing $800 million a year in gaming revenues because of the Vietnamese that went to Cambodia or Laos to gamble because they couldn't gamble in Vietnam. But and the casinos as well are lobbying the government to allow the locals, to extend it, to allow the locals to come in and gamble in the Vietnamese casinos. But it looks like the government's not going to allow that. They're going to allow that trial to expire. So the Vietnamese that want to gamble will again have to go to Laos and Cambodia to gamble on the border casinos or anywhere else. But I don't think they'll be allowed in Vietnam. Singapore, I think, will remain like it has been. With some restrictions on locals. So I don't really see anywhere that the locals are going to be allowed to go into their home-based casinos. I think they should just to help the local economy, but I don't see it happening.
Now, Bill, we couldn't have you on and talk about casino tourism without discussing where it is that you're currently based, Las Vegas, the global hub of gaming tourism, until perhaps Macau started to usurp that in terms of numbers. So how do you've worked in the US, you've worked here in Asia in these arenas. How do you compare then contrast the approach of casino tourist operators and casino tourists themselves in the US and in Asia?
Well, yeah, I think Macau and Vegas are quite similar. Here in Vegas, though, we've got a big country where the locals can gamble. So Americans can come to Vegas, they can gamble. And with the pandemic easing a bit here in the US, a lot of the people are coming here. The streets, the strip is very full. The casinos are full and people are now maskless. So there's some concern there. And another area too is Sihanoukville. I think they've been hit very hard. I think they had too much development there in Sihanoukville. And they started pulling back even before the pandemic. But with the pandemic, their only base is really Chinese gamblers. And there's the travel into Sihanoukville is very infrequent now and restricted. So I think Sihanoukville is going to be hurting for quite a while. Macau, though, I think is going to recover just as Vegas is. I really see them as being quite similar.
Let's talk hotels now. So you've been a regular contributor to Hotelia Indonesia magazine for a decade. How did that relationship begin? And how has content and story angles developed during that time?
Well, I got to know the managing editor of Hotelier Indonesia quite well, roughly 10 years ago when I was living in Bali. He was at that time based in Bali as well. So we'd meet on occasion, discuss story angles and so on. And I hooked up with him, I think, when he was just on his second issue. So he was welcoming any content I could bring. So I'd bring content that was in Indonesia, but also from my various travels into Thailand and elsewhere. So I'd feature the top hotels, the top spas throughout Asia, and even expanded into the Middle East, expanded worldwide to whatever we thought was interesting. So the content has not really changed. It's been a focus really on the top tier hotels and topics of interest to hoteliers in Indonesia and worldwide. So, and I think it's mostly just a web-based PDF type publication now. The initial issues were printed, but most publications going to the soft copy now, so it's expanded there as well.
And in terms of the content you mentioned hasn't changed, I guess hotels are looking much more at the sort of digitization and the technology side of going forward, which is an area that you specialize in. Has that been sort of a content angle, really, really looking at how you can make hotel industry more touchless, more frictionless, and much more convenient for guests in future without actually having to interact with people?
Almost certainly. We're going into the contactless, engaging with the customers where they can give their opinion of the hotel, their opinion of the property without connecting with staff. They can do it from various touch points around the hotel. So that's a hot topic right now that we're getting into. We're also expanding it more into booking solutions and even expanding more into golf, more into spas. So we're highlighting every aspect of the hotel that they're expanding into. So we're doing the hotels with golf, the hotels with spa, and expanding every way we can.
Yeah, I mean, I think nowadays all hotels are looking for any opportunity, right, to improve and to grab revenue. So it sounds like you're doing a great job at highlighting some of those opportunities. So in addition to golf, to casinos, to spas, to hotels, you're also involved with community development and agricultural sustainability projects. What's going to be the major challenges and opportunities for those in the near term?
Well, a lot of these sustainability projects are run and managed by people who don't get paid very much or by volunteers. So it's very difficult for them, impossible actually, for them to come into a new country, say Malaysia or Cambodia or wherever, and pay for a two-week quarantine. So the staffing of these community development projects is way down. They're in desperate need for help, but it's not really going to pick up until everybody can basically be safe and travel safely. It's an area that needs a lot of work. Needs a lot of staff, but again, they just can't do it at the moment.
And in terms of yourself, Bill, you mentioned there that the pandemic is generally easing in the US. So there are state-to-state differences, but the vaccination rollout has been pretty successful. People are starting to travel again. There's talk of US and the UK rebooting transatlantic travel, more Americans perhaps traveling into Europe. But obviously the situation with Asia is much, much different. From your own personal perspective, you know, what are your viewpoints? What are you looking at in terms of the near future? Do you think you'll be able to get back to Asia anytime soon?
I certainly hope so. I'm fully vaccinated, but I honestly hope that these governments require a COVID vaccination passport for people who travel. Going to Kenya quite a bit in the 90s, I've always been vaccinated with the yellow fever, and everywhere I go, I carry my yellow fever vaccination passport with me. So carrying a COVID vaccination passport would be no big issue for me. I know some people here in the U.S. are fighting it. I don't know if they're fighting it in other places, but it's really needed. I had a friend actually when I was living in KL, a friend from Kenya came to visit me, and she flew into Singapore's Changi Airport. And when she went to immigration, they asked for her yellow fever vaccination passport, and she forgot it. So they had to give her a vaccination there in the airport in Changi and wait 2 hours to see what type of reaction she had. And then she could come out. I think the same should be with a COVID vaccination passport. If you arrive at an airport in a new country and don't have it, you need to either fly back home or get your vaccination there and pay for a two-week quarantine. I think the vaccination passports are very necessary. And I'll always have mine with me when I travel around Asia, when I travel around the world. So I think it's very necessary.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I also carried a yellow fever, the little yellow book when I went out to South America many, many years ago. It was pretty dog-eared by the time I left, but I still had it in my pocket. But I agree with you on COVID passports. I just think the problem at the moment is just governments just seem so reluctant to integrate their technologies, the tracking apps. There is a huge degree of intergovernment issue about interoperability of these passports. But I think they are the only way that we're going to get travel rebooted in any significant way.
Yeah, I think Gary and I are firm vaccine passport believers, as our listeners will know, and testing believers. So that brings us to the end of the questions for today's show. Thank you so much, Bill, for coming on. It's been super interesting to learn more about casino tourism, golf tourism, spa tourism, and where you think that those are going to go in Southeast Asia over the next couple of years or so. And that brings us to the end of today's show. We hope you enjoyed the podcast, and don't forget to send us your thoughts and comments on what we discussed with Bill or what we missed out. You can drop us an email at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com or message us on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show or Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
Yeah, meanwhile, you can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full back catalogue on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com. or on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Podchaser, Castbox, Overcast, Podcast Addict, and Stitcher. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on each app. And if you do listen to us on Apple Podcasts, please remember to rate and review us, as that helps other people to find the show.
So that's a wrap for today, but we will be back tomorrow with a special Thailand reopening edition with David Lukens of the Thai Island Times newsletter. So join us for that. Bye for now.